Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And, Jim, there's good news, bad news with the South Carolina primary being on Saturday. The good news is that until the next round of primaries, we won't have to see an endless parade of ads going, Jim Garrity, can you trust his judgment? He cheers for the Jets. all back and forth. Everybody's a liar who's in double digits in the polls, depending on what the issue of the day is. South Carolina just gets rough and tumble, and that's part of it. You and I are in Virginia. We'll certainly be getting those ads here in the next few days as the candidates pivot towards Nevada and then Super Tuesday, which is March 1st. But South Carolina hopefully will be a good martini in one sense, that regardless of how things turn out, hopefully we'll have a smaller field heading into Nevada and Super Tuesday. Right now, we're down to six candidates. There's a lot of people who think if Ben Carson, who has consistently said he thinks he can win South Carolina but doesn't seem to be even at 5% in most of the polls, gets drubbed, maybe he gets out. Jeb Bush, there's a lot of reports that his campaign might be towards its latter stages, barring a major upset and strong performance on Saturday. And who knows where else everybody else is going to shake out. There's major expectation games here. And, of course, the money situation is going to factor into all these campaigns. But the idea that we might be down to a smaller field to the candidates that can actually win this thing is probably good for conservatives.
Longtime listeners to the Three Martini Lunch, Greg, are going to say, I'm detecting a contradictory train of thought between the two of you. You and I complain that Virginia doesn't matter, even though we're going March 1st, that Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina get to basically, you know, you can just kind of picture the Sith going through the wheat field, you know, kind of thinning the herd and weeding out all the slow antelopes out of the out of this, and before any of us get a chance to say this. On the other hand, it's been rather annoying that we had 14 aspiring narcissists up on that stage, each one convinced that there is a president looking back at them in the mirror. We had so many people. It's good to, you know, at some point, it's kind of good to say to the guys who don't have a chance, thank you for your time. Thank you for making your sales pitch. The electorate just isn't that interested. Anybody who finishes fourth, fifth, or sixth is going to have a tough time continuing after South Carolina. We can argue about whether or not that's fair. We can argue about who that's going to be. There is one poll out that had Ted Cruz actually fourth. I have a tough time buying that, but it's out there. It's not inconceivable that Marco Rubio ends up coming in fourth behind Jeb Bush. There are a couple polls that have John Kasich up in that third place spot. As you mentioned, it's not easy to see a scenario for Ben Carson here. The polls are not looking good. Yeah, the polls can be wrong, but it's not like you're going to see Ben Carson jump from like 5% to 30% in the next one. You look at all the states coming in March 1st, March 15th, March 8th, the ones coming up. There's not a ton of polling in those states, but generally they've all had one or two. And for these guys, Ben Carson and John Kasich and Jeb Bush, they're all pretty much in single digits. Kasich is the one that baffles me, Greg, because he has spent 2 days this week in Michigan. Michigan votes March 8th. So we've got South Carolina, and Kasich has already announced he's not going to be in South Carolina on primary night. He's not expecting to give any victory speeches. He's probably going to perform not that well. He's going to perform, you know, probably in the somewhere in the single digits, high single digits or low double digits if he's doing well. Excellent chance he's probably somewhere in that 5 to 10% range. But he's not looking that good in any of the March 1st states either. So by the time Michigan votes, 20 states will have voted. And the guy who everybody was buzzing about having this second place finish in New Hampshire has basically been off the stage and had two or three really bad weeks. Same, very similar situation for Carson. And Jeb Bush, you know, like, just how excited are we supposed to be about a fourth place finish in New Hampshire? Fourth place in South Carolina, very conceivably, maybe even fifth place. You know, it's very bizarre. The justification for Jeb Bush is going to be very hard after this. There have been rumors about his campaign running out of hard money. We'll see how it shakes out. But the South Carolina is a state that traditionally had been very good to the Bush family. And the idea of Jeb Bush continuing after this, if he performs very badly, is going to be kind of hard for a lot of Republicans to swallow. It's looked like a three-man race for a while now. I think it's, you know, if it shakes out the way people think it do, which is, you know, Trump will win South Carolina by a decent amount. Either Cruz or Rubio is going to be in second place. And interesting, a lot of the polling has these two guys pretty close to each other. Then maybe at that point, it's time to, you know, gold, silver, and bronze, and everybody else go home and kind of focus on this. And also, as these campaigns continue, you generally tend to see the voters tend to congregate around the front runners. People, fairly or not, see voting for a guy who's at 3%, 4%, 5% as a wasted vote. They want to influence amongst the top two or three, and that's how they're going to do it. So maybe we're going to see some consolidation here. And if you feel like, you know, the best chance of stopping Trump is to not have it Trump versus a crowd, but to have it Trump versus one or two other options, you know, South Carolina is going to do its duty this weekend.
Well, one would hope so. I can imagine Carson saying he's invested in the southern states, so he's going to hang around maybe for Super Tuesday. Kasich, you know, is going to go at least probably till Michigan, unless he just gets completely obliterated. So we hope it gets down to about three, but we'll find out over the weekend, because this expectation setting game seems to kind of drive the media's interpretation of where the campaign stands. Because if a candidate says, well, I don't really care about that state, then when they do poorly there, they're like, oh, well, he's focusing on Michigan, or he's focusing on Alabama, or whatever state happens to be coming up for that particular campaign. So it sounds like from what you're saying that there are limits to the expectation spin game.
Since you began this segment by taking a shot at my Jets, Greg, I'm going to make my case to all those guys, including, by the way, Rubio, right? Who, you know, is a very close third place, and then he was in fourth place, and, you know, he could come anywhere from second to fourth on this one. I'm going to quote the great philosopher Herm Edwards. The point of the game is to win the game. You don't just play it to just play it. For all of these, it was a really good fifth place, you know, and all these different spaces. At some point, you have to start winning. And if you don't come into at least a strong third out of this, and your name isn't Ted Cruz and your name isn't Donald Trump and you haven't won anything, when do you begin winning? When does the good part start for your campaign? Because for a lot of these guys, the strategy is, and then a miracle happens and we win Texas or something like that. It just, there's no reason to think you're going to perform badly in South Carolina and then somehow get this amazing shot of momentum in subsequent contests.
It reminds me of late last year when we were talking about Trump the board game from the 1980s, and the motto was, it's not whether you win or lose, it's whether you win.
You know, it was foreshadowing, Greg.
I guess so. All right, on to the bad martini now. And this one's a little bit local, a little bit personal, but it's still really bad. And it has been happening a lot in recent years in the Northern Virginia area. Jim lives in Fairfax County, which is the largest school district in the state. I live in Prince William County, which is the second largest school district in the state. Jim's kids are actually in school, although not very much, given the weather. And now, on March 1st, they won't be in school anymore because the Fairfax County Board of Education has decided, you know what, there's going to be a lot of people coming to vote, and a lot of these elections are held in schools, and it'll be a different kind of school day. So, stay home, kids. Let the people vote. So for those of you looking for a little bit of normalcy in the Northern Virginia area, maybe this is true in other counties around the country and other jurisdictions around the country as well. Somehow Election Day got turned into an everybody stay home day rather than just letting the kids experience what it's like to be part of the process.
You know, Greg, my understanding here in Authenticity Woods, Fairfax County, that if it snows on primary election day, the universe closes. Everything is totally closed. Nothing, you know. It didn't take me completely by surprise. I was a little incredulous when this was first proposed because, Greg, I don't know about you, I remember in New Jersey seeing people voting at my middle school and at my high school. Like, we just did it. Like school went on. There were grown-ups in the hallway, you know. Don't bump into them, right? Like why? All of a sudden it was this, like, disruptive, we can't have you know, adult citizens and high schoolers interacting. Safe space or something. It was a bizarre – I don't really understand this. So the really cynical interpretation of this is either that the teachers want the day off and the teachers' unions want the day off so they can get out the vote, or that for some reason that this is a way to mobilize a group in favor of a particular candidate. I don't understand this. I think if anything, maybe it's a good opportunity for the kids to say, this is what elections are. This is how elections work. Exactly. Maybe if the kids see people voting, they'll be more likely to do this when they turn 18. I the logic of it escapes me. It's not terribly surprising. You know, Fairfax County schools will close at the drop of a hat. or a single snowflake. And that's, you know, that's where we've come to at this day. I do think it says there's something unnerving about the philosophy at work in this circumstance.
Certainly is. And when I was growing up in elementary school, my parents voted in the same school where I went. So we just went early in the morning. And I actually remember standing in line with my mom as early as kindergarten and actually going into the booth with her. Back then it was the pull the lever kind. We didn't take a long time, but she would kind of explain what was happening. And we had talked about a lot of the races even before we went to the polls. So I kind of knew what was going on in the races. Just fascinating to watch. I'm sure I was more of a political nerd than a lot of kids, but it was just interesting to be part of the process. And by fourth grade, I was running downstairs after I had been to the polls with my mom, trying to hand in a sheet of notebook paper to the poll worker to vote. But
Greg Corumbus's first effort at voter fraud.
It's a good thing James O'Keefe wasn't there back then. That would have been trouble.
There you go. He was actually saying, hey, how do you get this video camera to work? somebody's going to make an animated series, Conservative Babies, all about us in our younger years. I do also, while we're on this, you know, we're reentering well off the topic, but I think this is good radio, Greg. So also I remember the same thing of going into the booth with my parents and, you know, seeing the lever and all that kind of stuff. And I remember subsequently poll workers saying, no, you can't bring kids into the booth. And I remember thinking, like, well, wait, why not? What are you afraid? Like, the kid's going to cast the ballot? This is how kids learn, right? They should see this process. This should not be something that's, you know, think about it. They can have access to violent video games and internet porn, but they can't see people casting ballots.
Priorities. And enjoy trying to find out something to do with your kids while you still have to go to work, parents in Virginia.
Yes, maybe it's meant to drive down turnout amongst parents.
Dastardly.
Sinister.
Plan. Dastardly plan. Well, you knew it was coming, folks. The crazy martini is Donald Trump's dust up with Pope Francis. Trump's gotten in a feud with everybody else, so why not the pontiff? This all started with a question, and as you'll hear, as Brett Baer of Fox News reads the transcript, since none of this was in English, or at least the Pope's comments weren't in English, it was a pretty leading question, but here's the question, and the Pope's response is read by Brett Baer of Fox News.
The question, Donald Trump in a recent interview said you, the Pope, are a political man and that maybe you are a pawn of the Mexican government as far as immigration policy is concerned. He has said that if elected, he would build a 25-kilometer long wall along the border. He wants to deport 11 million illegal immigrants, thus separating families, etc. I would like to ask you, first off, what do you think of these accusations against you and if an American Catholic can vote for someone like this? Pope Francis says, thank God he said I was a politician because Aristotle defined the human person as animal politicus. So at least I'm a human person. As to whether I am a pawn, well, maybe, I don't know. I'll leave that up to your judgment and that of the people. And then a person who thinks only about building walls, wherever they may be, and not building bridges, is not Christian. This is not in the gospel. As far as what you said about whether I would advise to vote or not to vote, I am not going to get involved in that. I say only that this man is not Christian if he has said things like that. Mm-hmm. We must see if he said things in that way. And this, in this, I give the benefit of the doubt.
And of course, Trump came back with his trademark humility.
If and when the Vatican is attacked by ISIS, which, as everyone knows, is ISIS's ultimate trophy, I can promise you that the Pope would have only wished and prayed that Donald Trump would have been president. For a religious leader to question a person's faith is disgraceful. I'm proud to be a Christian, and as president, I will not allow Christianity to be consistently attacked and weakened, unlike what is happening now with our current president. No leader, especially a religious leader, should have the right to question another man's religion or faith. They're using the Pope as a pawn, and they should be ashamed of themselves. That's the Mexican government.
Oh, Jim, so many different ways to go here. This is Donald Trump, who, of course, made suggestions that Seventh-day Adventism was odd when he was talking about Ben Carson, said that Ted Cruz, his conduct means you got to question whether he's truly an evangelical and all this sorts of thing. But the bottom line here is that Trump has a point that wanting to build a wall or having border security is not unchristian. But of course, anything involving Trump and any sort of feud is just going to go into the theater of the absurd.
There are times I just feel angry at the world, Greg. And this is one of those moments where I'm kind of mystified that you realize that so far in this campaign, we've seen Vladimir Putin offer his lengthy opinion of Donald Trump, right? And generally flattering to Trump. And Trump said, oh, you know, he said I'm a genius. I like him so far. So I guess that's all Kim Jong-un would need to do, you know, say nice things about Trump. And suddenly, the, you know, President Trump would be very sympathetic to the needs of the North Korean people. And then the Pope weighs in. I'm waiting. Are we going to get an Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi ISIS statement on Trump? Why does every world leader feel the need? Wasn't England, you know, contemplating legislation to bar him from the country?
Yes.
I mean, like, we have this circumstance in which all kinds of foreign leaders feel the need to weigh in on this. And the interesting thing is that they either don't know or they don't care that by – at least in the case of the Pope, like, this is only going to strengthen Trump amongst his supporters, right? I don't think it's going to be particularly persuasive to those. I'm unnerved to hear the Pope – he says he doesn't want to weigh in on the American presidential election. Some of my colleagues are apparently really up in arms about this. I think some pieces will be going up on National Review Online this afternoon discussing this. One thing that kind of comes out at me, Greg, look, I think of myself as a Catholic, not a particularly good one. I try to be respectful to the Pope. I really love the teachings of the church, but I don't necessarily put turn the other cheek on my national security policy. I want to build prosperity. The church is, you know, most members of the church take a vow of poverty, right? I mean, like the priorities of a godly institution and the priorities of a national secular institution are going to diverge at times. And so I don't doubt that Pope Francis's viewpoint on immigration would always be welcome everybody. Everyone is a child of Christ and you must, you know, reach out to them with an open heart. We also have drug dealers. We also have gangs. We need to balance these competing interests. And I think, you know, in a bizarre circumstance, Trump has a very legitimate point that this statement from the Vatican doesn't really look at the perspective of security, doesn't really look at the perspective of how do we protect people. But again, I just kind of marveling about the fact that, you know, other candidates are talking about, oh, look, this state senator endorsed me. And Trump is fighting the Vatican. I mean, it's kind of like watching, you know, a slap fight next to Godzilla versus Mothra.
And what do you think Marco Rubio's thinking? He just got the Nikki Haley endorsement less than 24 hours before, and now nobody's paying attention to that. He's got to be banging his head against the wall somewhere.
Or alternately, he's kind of like, Your Holiness, feeling like endorsing? I think I'm the only Catholic left. So here you go.
You couldn't script this campaign, that's for sure. Jim, we'll see what happens tomorrow night, and we'll do a full recap and more on Monday. See you then.
Looking forward to Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please tune in again on Monday for the next Three Martini Lunch. Have a good weekend, everyone.